Excuse me. Yes, Your Honor. May it please the Court. I'm Randy Frederick, and I'm one of the attorneys representing the appellant in this case, Ms. Smith. I will be addressing the judicial estoppel argument, and Mr. Frederick will be addressing the retaliation argument. The district court's application of judicial estoppel in this case is due to be reversed for at least three reasons. First, the district court applied and heavily relied on the Burns and Barger cases, which this court overruled en banc and Slater. Second, the district court improperly ignored or disregarded Smith's declaration in opposition to summary judgment, which this court in United States versus Stein said a district court cannot do. Third, the district court failed to resolve reasonable inferences in favor of Ms. Smith. The en banc court in Slater stated that a court should look at all the facts and circumstances of the particular case.
So let me ask you this, just as a factual matter here, even though the decision comes before Slater, is there really any material inconsistency with Slater? I mean, it looks to me, as you read the record, that he is referring to kind of facts and circumstances. He's talking about motive and whether, you know, it was designed to make a mockery of the judicial system. And, you know, we've got a post-Slater case, Weekly versus Eagle Logistics, which sort of sets up like this one, decision before Slater, then comes Slater, but we look at it and we say we don't need a remand for a Slater determination because it looks to us that this is kind of good enough, that it meets Slater substantively.
The facts in the Weekly case were far more egregious, and with all due respect, sir, in this case, the facts are not disputed except as to the original allegation and the original complaint. And what is agreed upon by all parties is that that allegation was mistaken. The defendants denied it in their answer. They submitted documents and evidence that contradicted that allegation in their motion for summary judgment. Smith's own declaration contradicts that allegation in the original complaint.
But doesn't the district court, I mean, the district court says, what I'm concerned about here is the entire sequence of events, he calls it, and the chronology. You know, your client says this in the complaint, then they answer, and then there's this absolute about face. And the district court says, looking at all of that stuff, I would call it facts and circumstances, looks like there's a motive, looks like this was intentional.
I understand that, Your Honor, but what this court said in Slater was judicial estoppel should not be applied when inconsistent positions were the result of inadvertence or mistake.
Right, and I guess what I'm saying is that it seems to me as a factual matter, the district court has said, like, this wasn't inadvertence or mistake. Slater certainly says the inconsistency alone ain't enough. Got to be more. And it seems like the district court here, even though acting before Slater, sort of anticipated Slater and said, I'm not resting on the inconsistency alone.
The court, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, Judge Newsom, all of the facts in this case indicate, and I see my time is out, all of the facts in this case indicate that Ms. Smith did not know at the time she was employed and during the pendency of her bankruptcy case that she had a claim at all. If she did not know, there was no failure to disclose, and there was no misleading the court, and judicial estoppel wouldn't apply to begin with. I'm sorry, my time is up.
May it please the court, thank you for this opportunity today. The opinion below in this area of retaliation law is an anomaly that should not stand. It's contrary to the United States Supreme Court case, Bill Johnson Restaurants, a seminal case in this whole area of the law, in which the Supreme Court said, and I quote, there is, quote, no doubt that employer may use the instrument of the lawsuit as a powerful instrument of coercion or retaliation. This opinion below is contrary to that principle, which applies equally to counterclaims. The court's decision below is contrary to this court's decision, NLRB versus United States Postal Service, on which Judge Joe Fites, who you said on the panel, issued that preceding decision, where this court held that an unlawful threat of retaliation does not have First Amendment protection. And the court below, he felt the threat here was worthy of First Amendment protection because it's stated by one lawyer to another lawyer. There's nothing in law that gives an attorney a pass in making threats on behalf of the employer. A threat the employer cannot itself make should not be allowed by the employer's attorney.
But to succeed, do you have to show that the threats are empty, that there's nothing to these claims? I mean, surely there's protection in negotiating a lawsuit about, like, I've got some real live, honest-to-goodness claims I'm going to bring.
I don't think you get to it unless the claim is filed. Then you get to whether it has some foundation in fact or law.
So you've got you can't negotiate pre-filing even if you've got a winner, a lock-solid cinch winner?
There was no negotiation here, Judge. There was an ultimatum.
So you can't make an ultimatum about a winner? I mean, are we not looking through to the merits a little bit to see whether these claims are any good?
If you do, there's no good. For example, the Haynes testified, we have no intention to sue her. But nonetheless, the attorney said, if you don't dismiss your case, there will be counterclaims. And that is... That's a threat. This court's decision blood is anomalous because it's the only case in the country that does not recognize such language as a threat. Only one I found. I've read hundreds of them. I said that's contrary to the Supreme Court case statement in Bill Johnson Restaurant, and it's contrary to this court decision, NLRB versus United States Postal Service, in which this court held an unlawful threat has no First Amendment protection.
So I guess the question I'm trying to get at is, and you said a second ago, and if you do look through to the merits, these are terrible, and so they're empty threats. But does NLRB get you all the way to the point of saying, like, no matter how strong the counterclaim is, you can't tell your adversary, I intend to file the counterclaim?
The NLRB case goes where it has First Amendment protection on which the court decision below to relies. So the answer to the question is no, I do not think NLRB addresses that point.
So do you think to prevail on this argument, you've got to knock down the claims, the would-be counterclaims on the merits to say there was nothing to this one, nothing to that one?
I submit for the plaintiff to prevail here, all she has to prove the threat was retaliatory.
Okay.
And how do you do that? Two ways, direct evidence or circumstantial evidence. Joe Flatt laid out in the Bell versus Birmingham Linen Service case a long time ago about what direct evidence is. It's evidence, excuse my speech impediment, so it's post-stroke.
No, you're fine. We got it.
Joe Flatt said in that case for the court, direct evidence is evidence that proves a point without inference. And so it cannot be had to mean anything other than the unlawful activity motive, the retaliation here. Here, it's a retaliatory on his face. If you don't dismiss this case, which is protected conduct, the case, we will file the counterclaims. We're going to sue you, in other words. The court below held erroneously there is no direct evidence. It's on his face. I don't know how the court avoided that, did not see that, it did not explain, and it's just somebody said there's no direct evidence here. The same is true of Russ Parker's suspension from Neal, Alabama chapter. The letter by which we suspended, because you had sued one of our members, the protected conduct, your membership in this chapter is suspended throughout the duration of the lawsuit. That's why I'm in this case. When I saw that, I thought, as I got older, I started thinking about our profession more. That's bad, bad for our profession. When you attack an attorney personally or professionally here based on his representation of his client this way in this retaliatory fashion, that's just bad for our profession.
But is that conduct attributed to anybody in this case?
The Alabama chapter was loaded with what I call the defendant, the Haynes loaded board of directors. The board made that decision according to the letter itself. On the face of the letter, it said, our board voted to suspend you. That board includes Mr. Greer, who's sitting right here. There's evidence of that. Mr. Greer submitted his own declaration. He was not on the board, but the then president of Neal, Alabama said, in his recollection, Mr. Greer was on the board then. Mr. Saxon himself was on the Alabama board. Kenny Haynes was. Elise Haynes was. There's evidence to this.
Do I recall factually that did Alicia recuse from this decision?
Hank Scherer testified that he did not discuss it with her. So, yes, in effect.
Okay, I gotcha. Anyone else? Any of the other principals that you just named, were they... What do we know about their involvement in the decision, one way or the other?
We know they were on the board. There's evidence they were on the board, but evidence, the undisputed in writing, the board voted to suspend Mr. Parker. They take the position of that was Susan Hampshire himself, but that's not what the letter says. That inconsistency is evidence of pretext in and of itself.
What can I ask you this? What about... on the retaliation issue, even if you get beyond the prima facie case, you know, they've said, look, there's a legitimate concern here about exposure to our work product, and so, you know, we've got to kind of create a wall of some sort. What's the evidence to rebut that non-retaliatory explanation that shows that that's pretext?
He was not merely excluded from listserv. He was suspended from membership in the organization entirely. The bylaws of Neela, Alabama does not require suspension from listserv. It does not require suspension of membership, only withdrawal removed from listserv. Gotcha. Which I couldn't understand that, but that's not what happened. It went much further. On the circumstantial evidence side, my time's going down. I just want to let the court, I rely on what Reese on that.
You saved some rebuttal.
Thank you.
Ms. Leonard?
Your Honors, may it please the court. My name is Heather Leonard, and along with Charles Greer, we represent Haynes & Haynes, Alicia Haynes, and Kenneth Haynes. The two issues before the court are united with a common theme. What evidences intent? Because both of these issues focus on intent. With judicial estoppel, was there an intent to make a mockery of the judicial process? And with retaliation claims, are the actions claimed by appellant Jenny Smith the result of a retaliatory motive by Haynes & Haynes, Alicia Haynes, and Kenneth Haynes?
Well, with regard to that first issue, in your brief, you described the conduct of Ms. Smith as cold manipulation.
Correct.
I have tried to understand who was manipulated by anything she did. It was a Chapter 13 bankruptcy with a plan that called for 100% payment of her debt. Your client didn't rely on it because they denied the allegation. The suit was filed later. I just don't understand who is manipulated.
And Judge Antoon, part of the reason this case is a little different is because it's in a judicial estoppel case with a bankruptcy element. The bankruptcy representations are not the sole reason that we see Judge Proctor in his analysis finds that her claims are estopped. With respect to the bankruptcy issue, he notes that she derives a benefit because she did not accurately reflect her income. When she began working for Haynes & Haynes, she didn't report the increased...
Who is injured when she does that?
Pardon?
Who is injured when she does that?
That would have been her creditors.
Her creditors?
Correct.
And who else?
At that point...
And trustee? And the court? Did the court accept and act on her failure to... disclose?
The bankruptcy court or the district court?
No, the bankruptcy court. The first court, if you look at New Hampshire versus Maine, the sine qua non is a reliance by the first court on the representation.
Correct, Your Honor. There's no evidence in the record that the first court knew of the misrepresentation because Ms. Smith was discharged from bankruptcy in January of 2013.
Well, one would be that... If the court discharged her on whatever she presented, but I understand she wasn't discharged.
You're right, Your Honor. I misspoke. She was dismissed due to noncompliance with the plan in January of 2013.
So not all of her creditors are out there to make claims.
Correct, Your Honor. And we're not arguing that this is like a Chapter 7 where there is where the creditors would have been defrauded. The distinction between a 13 and 7 that's laid out in the Slater case is very helpful in drawing the distinction. But as this court noted in Slater, still when we're looking into 13, there is a motive on the part of the plaintiff or the non-disclosing party to deceive. And that's where Judge Proctor's opinion really gets into this court's Slater analysis.
Who is deceived?
With respect to this case, we first have the district court with the about-face representations of Ms. Smith in her initial pleadings. She makes a representation.
About-face, she made an allegation in an unsigned pleading. We don't know whether she read it or not. It's signed by her lawyer. And then your client denies the allegation, and then the complaint is amended to delete the allegation. Is that right?
Those are all facts.
Well, how are you prejudiced? How is anybody prejudiced by this? Is a judicial estoppel, as I understand it, is a principle of equity. And I'm trying to sort out the equities here, and I'm starting out with trying to figure out who is injured.
Well, the injury would be to the integrity of the court.
Well, it's punishment, really.
Correct.
You know where I am in this. I don't think Chapter 13 has a thing to do with it versus Chapter 7.
Understood, Your Honor. And that's part of why I raised the distinction that this is an estoppel case with a bankruptcy element as opposed to a straight judicial estoppel case based on a failure to disclose with the bankruptcy court.
The punishment is to everybody else in the bankruptcy world, and you're punishing the debtor in a civil case before the district court.
And Your Honor, we in no way are advocating to...
If she got punished and it was dismissed, and the next day she went into bankruptcy, into seven, into Chapter 7, what would happen?
The assets would become the property.
The trustee couldn't do a thing, could he?
Correct. And that's where I keep coming back to. We think Slater is a fantastic opinion. We fully embrace that the court should look at all of the circumstances to determine were the actions of the debtor.
Is there any other area of the law with judicial estoppel where the party is punished?
No.
Really? The rules allow inconsistent pleadings.
Correct.
You cross-examine people who make inconsistent statements.
I follow your
own. Oh, any area of the law where somebody who makes inconsistent statements in a prior proceeding, forget bankruptcy, is punished in the district court and their claim is barred?
No, Your Honor. But that being said, the facts of this case are very specific. You have a complaint filed on behalf of a paralegal. Her lawyer signs it under Rule 11. He is empowered to speak on
it. Well, then go down to the bankruptcy court and have her sanctioned. The bankruptcy judge could send the case to the U.S. attorney.
She's no longer in bankruptcy.
I understand. Oh, court could still do it.
And this gets back to, Your Honor, the reason this is significant is because the representations go to the issue of the statute of limitations applicable to the FLSA claim advanced by Ms. Smith. The original complaint contains allegations that would have invoked the 3-year statute of limitations to allow her to claim her wage claims for the full period of time that she worked for Haynes & Haynes.
You know, those allegations that you're talking about in the initial complaint, evidence, when you read the emails and all of that, she wants a better deal. Really, she wants to renegotiate with her employer.
There's no
evidence that there was a claim at that point or that she understood that she had a right to make a claim, which gets me to one of the problems I have with this case. It was decided as a summary judgment. I think Slater was too. But in Slater, they said it's really not a summary judgment. It's I guess, more akin to a dismissal. But either, if you, under the first standard, I don't think there are any uncontroverted facts that would support the judgment. And if it's based on the facts of the case, I don't see any findings of fact, nor do I see any evidence other than the emails, which are unpersuasive, that would go to showing motive or intent or deception or any of the things that we're supposed to consider under Slater.
Well, and Your Honor, I think part of this, it's a two-part answer. First, it goes to Judge Proctor's opinion suggests that where he was finding was that there was an intent to deceive his court as to the plaintiff's knowledge of whether she had claims and put the defendant on knowledge of them to suggest that a willful violation would allow her to invoke the 3-year statute of limitations versus the 2-year statute of limitations. That's why when he writes in the opinion to say there's an obvious difference in reconciling the specific allegations of the plaintiff's original complaint with the subsequently filed affidavit is an understatement. Plaintiff has taken two diametrically opposed positions on the question of when she became aware of the complaint. But where the second issue goes is footnote 12 within Slater. Because in footnote 12, this court noted that even if the plaintiff's testimony about mistake is uncontroverted, the district court is not obligated to accept that. Judge Proctor engaged in an intensive factual inquiry going through the timeline. It's clear he doesn't use the two-part do not pass go, you didn't disclose it, therefore you immediately have judicial estoppel analysis that we see in Burns and Barger. Instead, he looks at the sequence of events going from when she files her initial bankruptcy in April of...
Talking about Judge Carnes' footnote.
But Carnes discusses the footnote, but footnote 12 is within the original opinion.
Wouldn't that contemplate, though, some other evidence rather than besides just the denial?
Well, and that's where Judge Proctor's opinion goes, is he says, look, if I look to the conduct that's occurred in my court in front of me relating to these issues, it suggests that this is the plaintiff attempting to manipulate the judicial process based on the exigencies of the circumstances.
And hold the party in contempt. Well, there's all kinds of things other than striking claims.
Correct, Your Honor. And
that if send them to the bar for an ethics clean house.
Well, Your Honor, I don't think Judge Proctor was too far away from doing something of that nature.
Your argument is that this is strictly, this rule of law is strictly with regard to a Chapter 13 bankruptcy. If somebody lies in Chapter 13 bankruptcy, the district court will punish them in a civil case involving that bankrupt.
That is not our position, Your Honor. And we encourage the district courts to follow Slater and have a fact-intensive analysis.
I understand that, but if the bankruptcy court did not rely on the misrepresentation...
And, Your Honor,
if it relied on the misrepresentation, the remedy's down there in the bankruptcy court. I realize I'm an outlier on this point.
And Your Honor, I think this is a discussion that needs to be had because of the effect that judicial estoppel has on people being able to legitimately pursue the claims. But when we look at Slater 2 and Slater 3, this court says, look, the factors we give you to analyze are an exhaustive list. But we want you to look at all of the facts. And here, under the abuse of discretion standard, we see that is what Judge Proctor did. The court may not like his outcome, but the court did look at all of the facts. He looked at the level of sophistication.
I realize that.
And
do you want to save some time for the other issue?
Yes, Your Honor, and thank you for that. When we move on to the retaliation issue, the adverse actions that are challenged here are not the type that evidence retaliatory intent on the part of Kenneth Haynes. When we look to the meeting between John Saxon and Russ Parker, this is the type of meeting that this court urged lawyers to have in the Sayers case before filing certain actions. As members of the VAR, we're held to a higher level of civility, and we should be talking about these things. The undisputed evidence is that neither Kenneth Haynes, Alicia Haynes, nor Haynes & Haynes as a group told Mr. Saxon to go to this meeting and say anything about counterclaims. They authorized their agent to go to this meeting and discuss the issue of judicial estoppel, which is what he did. Now, he may have taken other actions, and that's one of the reasons this case is kind of odd. On the one hand, on the estoppel argument, the plaintiffs argue that they cannot be bound by the actions of their attorney as an agent. But when we get to the retaliation claim, they do an about-face and say that a plaintiff or a party is 100% bound by the actions and intent of their actors. But the difference here is there's no evidence that when Mr. Saxon discusses any type of potential legal claims or theories that could be advanced by the defendants, he's acting on the direction of his clients. So there's no way to infer that those actions came from the intent of the plaintiff or the defendant. Your Honor, I apologize. I'm used to arguing for employees and plaintiffs, and being on the side is a little different. Sometimes I may misspeak on that. When we look to the issue of Russ Parker, this gets to what the court was talking about earlier. In that situation, we have a third party who makes a decision because Mr. Parker's presence within the group on the listserv would affect the collegiality and purpose of that to remove him. The actions by the defendant were solely to report to that group, hey, this lawsuit has been brought against us. You need to remove us from the listserv, at which point decisions were made. The record is unclear as to whether it was by the board or Mr. Sherrod. His testimony equivocates between the two. And his testimony also equivocates as to who actually was on the board at that time. When you look at his testimony, he says, I think Chuck, Mr. Greer, may have been on the board at that time. Mr. Greer's testimony is that he was not. He says Kenneth Haynes may have been. Mr. Haynes' testimony is he was not. It is undisputed that John Saxon was on the board, and Ms. Haynes was on the board. Mr. Sherrod's testimony was that Ms. Haynes was not included in the decision, and he couldn't remember whether Mr. Haynes was on the board at the time, but if he was, he would have been excluded from the decision. There's no indication that a retaliatory intent on the part of Haynes and Haynes led to the termination of Mr. Parker's membership in a 33-member collegial group that basically exchanges emails about the status of employment law. The bottom line here is the law of unintended consequences. As we noted, Benjamin Franklin and Poor Richard's Almanac, for the want of a nail. When Ms. Haynes reported the litigation to Neela, Alabama, it was not with the intent to have Mr. Parker removed, but rather so that she could comply with the guidelines and that she could be removed from the listserv. This is why Judge Proctor in footnote 5 does a really good analysis of the distinction between direct evidence and things that may be causally related. And he points out that the things that the appellant is arguing constitute direct evidence are really more the byproduct of an action. It doesn't reflect an retaliatory intent. As my plaintiff's practice is well aware of, this court's precedent on direct evidence sets a high bar because the evidence has to express the retaliatory intent of the actor, and that is simply not present here. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
The district court below, at his decision at page 7, stated the issue is whether plaintiff knew she had a claim for unpaid overtime against defendants at the time her bankruptcy petition was pending. All the evidence in this case indicates that she did not. Judge Joe Flatt, in the special concurrence in Slater 1, stated, inconsistent pleadings, however, whether or not under oath, are of no concern. Rule 8D of the federal rules permit inconsistent pleadings, and in my view, equity would not countenance a judge-made rule to negate that feature of Rule 8. What the district court here did is he negated the feature of Rule 8. He also negated the feature of Rule 15 that permits pleading amendments as a matter of right, which is what happened here. What happened here, in fact, is the original allegation was mistaken. It was wrong. It was denied by defendants. All parties submitted evidence that disputed it and established that that allegation was, in fact, mistaken.
It was probably made to show willfulness on the part of the employer, I guess.
I did not draft it. I was not representing the plaintiff at the time. I don't know why it was made, Your Honor. I don't. I wish I did. The bottom line is it was incorrect. But what I do think does show willfulness is the fact that these are experienced plaintiff's employment attorneys that she's working for. Let's not forget that. Haynes and Haynes are experienced plaintiff's employment attorneys. And when Ms. Smith did go to them and say she chose to forego overtime, I think that goes to one of the factors that Slater requires we determine the district court way, which is the sophistication of the plaintiff. It is obvious from her emails she didn't know that she could not choose to forego overtime. Obviously, if she thought she could choose to forego it, she was not aware she had a claim. And let's not forget that was 1 month before her employment ended. And I am out of time.
Judge Newsom, I thought about your question further. There's one case I cited in my principal brief that addressing your question is so versatile of a manufacturing company, it's a district court case. It says without the filing of a lawsuit, you don't get to the whether the claimed is supported or lacking foundation is on the whether threat is retaliatory, as this court did in its NLRB versus the United States Postal Service. That's cited at pages 34, 39 in our press brief, I believe.
Thank you.
You know, the fact is the threat was made by their attorney, not by themselves. Their attorney is agent of the employer here. This court said in Alliance of versus O'Quinn, 2018 U.S. at Lexus 24063, August 23, 2018, at footnote 3, employer is the attorney for the employer is the employer's agent for purpose of the litigation. So they could not say it to their office manager. They can't sue who's their agent. They could not say it to their attorney either. If you do get to whether I don't want to add something new to my rebuttal. I don't want to argue circumstantial evidence case, so I did not argue that before. Are we going to permit idle, empty threats when they, as you said, opposed the counsel stated, they have no intention to sue her. None of that, their counsel threatened to sue my client. We're going to tolerate idle threats to interfere with unfettered access to the courts. That's the purpose of anti-retaliation prohibitions, to bar unfettered access to the courts. Here, it does not matter to Matt. It matters to this court. It does not matter if she was already in court because they were trying to stop her from proceeding in the court. 6-1, half a dozen others, whether you go to court or whether you continue to proceed, there's no difference. But the court below thought that was erroneous, thought that would have made a difference. I don't know how the court would blow this direct evidence. You know, given they said, admitted here today, they had no attention to sue her, the client themselves, that proves they cannot prevail. They lose their direct evidence case. In the direct evidence case, the burden is on the employer defendant to demonstrate it would then take the same action anyway, regardless of retaliatory motive, which was present on its face. Here they denied they would have taken the same action. They said, we had no attention to sue her. That shows that their court's decision below had been erroneous. Had we not allowed to proceed, we win the case. Unless the court has questions, my time is up.
Thank you. That's the last case. The court will stand adjourned under the usual order.